Welcome to Stutter Talk, everybody. This is Peter Reitzis. Eric Jackson is in the production booth today, and I'm here with special return guest, Dr. Robert Quisel. Hey, Bob, how's it going?
Hi, Peter. How are you?
I am good. I'm good. I've been listening to some of your archived audio presentations that are at the Stuttering homepage, so I feel like I have your voice in my head today.
Okay.
Dr. Bob Quisel is a professor of communication sciences and disorders at Western Illinois University. He is a board-recognized specialist in fluency disorders and is a recent fellow of the American Speech Language Hearing Association. You have a lot more accomplishments, Bob, in and out of the world of stuttering, but I do not want to embarrass you. And this is episode 170, and we're linking to many of your articles from that episode. We're going to cover some big topics today, including empathy and forward-moving speech, but let's hit a couple of small things first. So the first thing I want to mention is I had a good laugh on the way to work today because I was listening to, I think, a 1998 keynote you gave at the National Stuttering Project, now the National Stuttering Association. And you had made the comment to the audience that you felt like you had to give good stutter.
Right.
And, you know, and our listeners of Stutter Talk know that I use voluntary stuttering on this show because I feel obligated in a good way to throw some stuttering out there. Do you want to take a second on that topic of feeling you have to or should or expected to stutter sometimes?
Well, I think it was more a case at that time when I was giving that keynote because I had never gone to an NSA convention at that time, and so when people were telling me about it, they were saying things like, "Well, you know, if you're going to give the keynote, you know, you should really stutter." And so it's like, you know, because if you don't stutter, then people are going to think that you're not really a stutterer and things like that. And so
Right. There
was this notion that, well, basically I just talk. You know, I mean, I'm at the point in my life, I think, where it's sort of hard for me to tease out whether I'm talking or I'm managing my stuttering or exactly what it is that I'm doing, because I've been doing these things for so many years now. And
right.
So, and I also find myself, for whatever reason, when I get up in front of a large group, I tend to be very, very fluent. And so I just felt at that time, it's like, well, here I am in front of this group, and chances are that I'm going to be fluent. And so do I really need to stutter? Is my message going to carry less weight if I'm up here and I'm talking about stuttering and I'm not actually showing a lot of overt stuttering? And so there's just more of a thing I had to sort of wrestle with at that time in terms of how credible is a person who stutters if they're not stuttering versus what I used to deal with, which was how credible can I be as an SLP if I do stutter, you know? So it's like,
Yeah. You're
damned if you do and you're damned if you don't.
I know that you're quite the expert on covert stuttering. You have a wonderful paper from 2007 on covert stuttering, and so I can add to all of that dilemma my feelings of standing up and trying to hide my stuttering.
Right.
There's layers and layers of this stuttering onion. So I want to out myself to you today that I'm going to be using a lot of good stutter today, Bob. A mutual friend of ours, Dr. Joe Klein, was recently on Stutter Talk, and he asked the question, where are all the stutterers? Would you like to take a stab at that, Bob?
Where all the stutterers?
Yeah.
I think that it sort of dovetails into what you just commented about, which is there are probably a lot of covert stutterers out there who are sort of passing as fluent speakers or trying to pass as fluent speakers. I often ask my students, for example, when we're talking in my class about the prevalence of stuttering, and, you know, you look at the numbers, and most of the data, the research that's been done says, you know, about 1% of the population stutters, you know, 5% has stuttered at any time in their life, and about 1% stutters, you know, at any time. And so we're at a campus here at Western. We have about 11,000 students on this campus. So I say to my students, there should be about 110 students, roughly, on this campus, or at least 100 students on this campus who stutter. And usually, we don't come up with that one out of out of 100. It may happen, but it happens in a fairly rare case. And certainly we haven't found 100 students on this campus who stutter. And so then the question becomes, well, like you're asking, well, then where are all the stutterers? But they'll often say, well, I met this guy or this woman. Most of the time it's a guy, of course, because more males than females stutter. And they'll say, well, I met this guy or I knew this guy or whatever. And I think he stuttered or something like that. They'll talk about how he spoke or whatever it might be. And then it's like, well, did you mention our clinic to him? And well, no, I really didn't, or something like that. And so my guess is that there are people out there who don't speak with highly fluent speech who, given the right set of circumstances, might be coming for speech therapy, or maybe have had speech therapy and didn't feel that they gained from it or benefited from it. They are these sort of self-taught or self-cured people who stutter, who, when you say to them, well, how did you learn to overcome your stuttering? They say, well, I learned to not say hard words, and I learned to not put myself in situations where I was going to have to talk and things like that, which essentially they learned how to avoid.
Yeah.
And in fact, there was even an article published a few years ago where they were talking about people who were reporting how they cured themselves of stuttering. And essentially, when you read the article closely, essentially these people are saying what they learned to do was to hide stuttering, you know. And so I really think that many of the people who are out there who probably do stutter are just sort of have found a way to either hide their stuttering or hide themselves, and therefore there are people out there who probably could be helped by us SLPs, but either people aren't aware that the services are available, or they've just sort of given up and said, well, I had therapy when I was in, you know, second grade or fifth grade or junior high school or whatever, and it didn't really help me, and therefore I don't believe therapy is of any value, and I'm just going to go on and live my life. When people think of stuttering, they think of Porky Pig. That's their note. And so if somebody's a stutterer and they have a lot of either prolongations or maybe blocks in their speech, people don't really necessarily think of that as stuttering as much as the idea that the kind of stuff. And if you're doing more of the kind of like prolongation kind of stretches in your speech, or you're having some tense pauses, people don't always necessarily think of that necessarily as stuttering. It's like, well, that person talks differently. And so there may be something in terms of like the public perception or whatever it might be as well. I think we meet people like that,
yeah,
and we start going, ah, I think that person stutters, you know, whereas a lay person might meet that person and say, well, that person talks funny, but I'm not really sure exactly what their problem is, because they don't sound like Porky Pig or something like that.
You know, I just had that experience. I was watching a documentary on the guitar player, songwriter, Richard Thompson. And he was in the band Fairport Convention. He's a folkie. And he was speaking in a way that sort of my ears immediately perked up. And I thought, if he came into my office and said he was a stutterer, I would take him very seriously. However, I doubt very much he identifies as a person who stutters, but that might be a whole nother big topic. So I know you're really interested in the topic and the issue of empathy in the field of stuttering speech therapy. And I want to read back to you a quote from a paper you had written, Empathy-Based Practice in Stuttering. As we take our first steps down the road of evidence-based practice in stuttering, what seems to be lacking in the scientific discussion is empathy. Can you tell us what you mean by that?
Well, I think that, and this is sort of my latest hang-up, one of many, but I'm actually going to be doing a talk next month at the Illinois Speech and Hearing Association convention, where I'm going to be talking about this as well. But the notion of, it seems to be very hard for people who don't stutter to truly put themselves in the shoes of the person who stutters. Okay, in other words, when you think about empathy, you know, sort of an armchair definition of empathy is putting yourself in the shoes of the other person.
Okay,
and there's other, you know, other in that article, I put, you know, put a number of other definitions of the term. But basically, it's like understanding the situation from the perspective of the person who's going through the experience. I think what causes a lot of SLPs to have trouble with understanding their therapies and why their therapies don't work is that they are not able to put themselves in the shoes of their clients who stutter. And there's a couple of things that I've thought about, you know, quite a bit that kind of tie into that. One is that when people who don't stutter have breakdowns in fluency, it's usually for one of two main reasons, I think. One is because they can't think of what they're going to say. So, you know, you're trying to stumble around, you're thinking, and you do that kind of stumbling around. Or you're nervous. You're talking too fast, or you're nervous, and so you're like, kind of a thing. And so what that leads to is the layperson tends to say to the person who stutters when they stutter, well, you need to either think of what you're going to say, or you need to calm down, right? You need to take your time or whatever, right?
Okay.
And I'm guessing you probably at some point in your life were told by somebody to either stop and think what you're going to say, or stop and start over again, or think what you're going to say, right? I mean, I'm guessing that you had somebody who was trying to be helpful with you, who probably gave you that advice. But I think many people who stutter, you know, have that sort of experience,
right,
where it's like, you know, just calm down. Well, I don't think that's necessarily bad when somebody like a parent or somebody who doesn't really know anything about stuttering says that, because again, they don't really know any better. But the problem is that there's also many SLPs who still look at stuttering through the prism, if you will, or through the lens of their experience of fluency breakdown. And therefore, when you talk about things like loss of control, getting stuck, even when Eric was talking in the last podcast I listened to, when you guys were talking about forward moving speech, and I think Eric was talking about the notion that when you're stuttering, you get stuck. You just have a moment where you're talking along and your mechanism just stops working. You know, you can't move ahead in speech. You know,
right.
you can talk about things like easy onsets and preparatory sets and whatever you want to talk about until the cows come home. But when you're in a moment of stuttering, you are stuck. You know, mm-hmm. your mechanism is not going to do anything. And that's the experience of stuttering as the person who stutters feels it, right? And so I think that unless people who are working with people who stutter, people who are SLPs, understand that notion of what the experience of stuttering is like for the kid who stutters or the adult who stutters, whoever they're working with. And they understand that when you're talking along and you come to a difficult word, whatever you want to call it, and you just get stuck and you are not able to use your techniques or use your tools or use your whatever you've been learning in therapy, or to understand that I can sit in therapy with my SLP and I can be as fluent as I'll get out, but I leave the room, and for whatever reason, those fluency skills just don't stick. Or the notion that I have good days and bad days, or some people are easier to talk to than others, or that, like I just talked about earlier, I can get up in front of 300 people at an NSA convention, and I can be more fluent than I am right now talking to you on the phone. You know,
right.
Why is that? What is it about stuttering that is that way? And the answer is, well, we don't really know. That's just the way stuttering is. And people who work with people who stutter have to understand that that's the nature of the disorder. It's a variable disorder. It's an involuntary disorder. It's experienced by the person who stutters as loss of control. And I think unless people who work with people who stutter really understand it at that level, that, you know, I can sit here and I can do these techniques until, you know, I'm blue in the face, until my client is blue in the face. But it doesn't mean that these techniques are always going to work.
Yeah, I used to tell my grad students that not only is stuttering variable, but your ability to use speaking strategies is also variable. In fact, I used to tell my grad students that at the end of the day, I really only know two things about stuttering, that it's variable and that people who stutter avoid stuttering to different degrees.
Right.
You know, and then everything else is harder to get about stuttering. You know, this is such a great topic. And I used to assign, when I was teaching a lot of grad courses, this article on empathy-based practice, because I loved your discussion on evidence-based practice, which I'll briefly share with the listeners is what, for better or for worse, is really starting to push our field, and which is having the therapist take into account not only research that's found in our peer-reviewed journals, but also the desires of the client and our experience as therapists. And you've pinpointed that, unfortunately, so many therapists and researchers in our field cling to this best evidence.
Right.
To having to see it in a peer-reviewed journal. And I agree with you, and I have to think it's simply because measuring stuttering behaviors is pretty easy compared to measuring covert behaviors and feelings. So I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Well, you know, I went to a very interesting session at ASHA on evidence-based practice, and the thing that they said at that session, which I thought was just wonderful, is they said, there's no evidence to show that evidence-based practice makes a difference.
I have to ask, who said that? That's great.
I'm trying to think who it was now. I'm trying to remember what the session was now, and I can't remember who it was. I'll have to go back and think. But anyway, and the other thing that they pointed out that was really excellent was that when you think about evidence-based practice, or you think about the search for evidence, if you will, evidence-based practice, the idea is you try to find the thing that works on average. Okay, in other words, you say that, you know, we've done all these studies, we've looked at people who stutter, let's say, as a group, and it appears that on average, people who stutter respond to this treatment. But when we're doing treatment, we've got one person sitting in front of us who may or may not be representative of that group, you know?
Yeah.
And so the thing is, when we're trying to use the evidence, we often are going to be stymied because we sit there and say, well, yeah, okay, this works for the average stutterer, but this guy sitting next to me or sitting across the table from me might not be the average stutterer. He may differ in some way from that average. And so therefore we can't necessarily try to force him into this typical stutterer, because he may not be the typical stutterer. So oftentimes the whole idea of evidence-based practice is at odds with what we do as SLPs. We don't treat groups, we treat individuals.
Yeah.
Evidence-based practice, the search is looking for what works sort of on average for the typical, if there is such a thing.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, and I also am starting to really look closely at some of these studies, and like I've been looking at a few of the Lidcombe studies, and I'm starting to think, Bob, that words are losing their meaning. Because when you read a study on long-term follow-up of Lidcombe, and you realize that some of the people who are being called long-term follow-up are 12 months out of therapy.
Uh-huh.
Now, I don't know about you, Bob, but in the life of a stutterer, 12 months can be nothing.
Uh-huh.
And the life of therapy or after therapy, it's so upsetting that a peer-reviewed journal would allow long-term anything to be 12 months. I don't get it.
Well, but see, my thing more so than the idea of 12-month follow-up, which I think in some ways 12-month follow-up for a kid who's, 3 years old or 4 years old is really a fairly good follow-up time. Again, my concern with much of the Lidcombe data is that they don't include, I can't remember what the phrase is, something like failure to comply is used with older clients, but the notion of if a kid does not respond to treatment, then they are ultimately excluded from the data. In other words, what you can basically conclude from Lidcombe is our treatments work for those for whom they work. I mean, that's what it boils down to. And it's not that it's not a good treatment. I am a firm believer that Lidcombe is a great treatment for many kids who stutter if you catch them early.
Okay.
But the notion is that there are a lot of kids who don't respond to Lidcombe, and those are the ones I think at this point in time should be studied. Why are these kids not responding? How are they different? What about them makes them not responsive to Lidcombe?
Yeah.
And how does treatment need to be then modified, tweaked, changed, different treatment for these kids who are not responsive to Lidcombe? And I don't think that research is being done. At this point, that's the more important research, because we know that Lidcombe works. It should work quickly. It should work for if you're not seeing this happen quickly, then there's something going on that's different. The question now becomes, what's different? Why are these kids different? How are these kids different? What can we do with them if they don't respond to Lidcombe, which is sort of now a first-line treatment?
Well, just for the listeners who don't know, Lidcombe is a therapy for preschoolers who stutter. It's based on operant conditioning principles. So the therapist would say things like, that was hard, make it smooth, or when the child was not stuttering, the therapist
it's also a parent administer treatment, yeah. And so therefore it's time that the parent and child spend together, so therefore the parents do a lot of the reinforcing of fluency and the correction of stuttering as well.
Yeah.
So again, it's something that essentially is done every day with the child. And again, there are a lot of very, very positive things about LIDCM, I think. But as I say, I think that there are kids who clearly don't respond to the treatment, and I don't think that those kids are being studied. So.
Yeah. I want to share with you that I know a therapist who does LIDCM exclusively.
Uh-huh.
The therapist refers to it as the gold standard, and everything else is lesser. And the therapist says very publicly that 100% of the clients are recovered from stuttering.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you ask questions, the therapist would then say, well, out of a group, let's say about 30 children who stutter, 5 of them have relapsed after several years. And then I ask the question, well, wait a second. You have 100% recovery, but 5 out of 30 of the children are still stuttering. How's that recovery? Well, because the parents aren't doing the program.
Right.
So I agree with you that I think there's a need to do that research. Unfortunately, I'm going to publicly question the interest of a lot of people who do LIDCM to do that research. And I'm going to share my concerns that some of the therapists I know who do the research are basically, instead of blaming the stutterer, will put the blame on the parent. They put
the parent,
blame on the parent. It's very troubling.
Well, but I think the sort of operant mindset has always been if the treatment is infallible. If the treatment doesn't work, it's either because the treatment was not applied correctly, i.e., the therapist did something wrong, or the client didn't do something correct. So it's either blame the therapist or blame the client, because the treatment is infallible. That's sort of the underlying theme that I take from the hardcore operant folks. Again, there are only a handful of those sort of hardcore operant folks that I'm aware of, but that's the message I take from that. And I think that some of the people who probably are the most empathy impaired are some of the hardcore operant folks. And so yeah. I think that, and again, most of those folks don't stutter. I think that there's an interesting thing going on there. Let's just put it that way, that many people who believe that fluency is the answer and have no interest in anything beyond fluency are people who themselves don't stutter, have never stuttered, apparently don't know any people who stutter, and look at this stuttering as a behavior that simply can be eliminated by telling people that they're doing a bad thing and they should just stop doing it. So,
yeah.
So
reading and listening to you the last couple of days, I completely agree with so much of what you say. And then a part of me just thinks, I can't worry about these very behavioral-based, fluency-based folks who are basically saying the gold standard is counting stutters on Monday and counting them on Tuesday. And if they're less on Tuesday, then you're doing your job.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure I'm ever going to, quote, fix them, you know, if that's the terminology. I'm not sure. I mean, I give you guys a lot of credit who are involved in ASHA and involved in the legislative aspect within the field. So I want to share with you one more quote that I pulled from your 2003 presentation. I laughed out loud when I heard it on my iPod this morning. This is from your presentation, Understanding the Speaker's Experience of Stuttering. You said, politics are masquerading as science in terms of evidence-based practice.
Right.
Do you want to explain that for a second?
Well, that was one at that time. Again, the notion was that we were, that was sort of the heat of battle. Again, there were two camps at that point. I think if you want to maybe talk about it in sort of simple terms, but there were the I probably shouldn't say this, but I will anyway.
Okay.
If you want to edit this out, you can. What I referred to as the fluency Nazis, the fluency uber alles folks, you know, the idea that the only goal was fluency. It was, you know, that the only thing we could measure was fluency. The only important thing was fluency. And then there were the touchy-feelies, you know, people like you and me and Bill Murphy and Scott Yaris and people like that. And so basically there were sort of these two camps. And so the notion was that when we looked at the notion of evidence, evidence-based practice, what constituted good therapy for stuttering, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, the argument at that point was something to the effect of, if you look at the journals, you look at the science, you look at, because the only place where the argument was something like this, the only place where you can really find true evidence is in a journal. You know, you don't go talk to your friends, you don't go to ask a presentation, you don't talk to your professors, you don't read a book. The only place where the true science exists is in journal articles, in peer-reviewed journal articles. And if you look at the peer-reviewed journal articles, the evidence you see in those articles almost without exception is evidence or articles that relate to operant treatments, because again, you know, operant treatments are the ones that are use surface fluency as their measure. You know, you stutter more, it's bad. You stutter less, it's good. That was essentially what the measures were. And again, so it's easier to publish an article that talks about those surface measures because you can count them. You know, you count stutters, et cetera, et cetera. And so the argument, or the conclusion drawn then, was the notion that therefore we should only be doing operant therapies because those are the only ones that had evidence to back them up. Does that make sense?
You know what? It makes sense just because I know it so well, but it's so so sick. It's so sick.
And so then we had the evidence-based treatments, and we had what somebody called the assertion-based treatments. So those of us who believed that there was more to stuttering than surface disfluency or surface fluency, and believed that there was something going on under the surface that was harder to measure, we were assertion-based therapists. And so I decided to form this group that I called ABSTARD, ABSTARD, Assertion-Based Stuttering Therapist Association Rejecting Data.
That's so great. I didn't know about that group. I would love to join that group.
To be a little absurd. But the thing that was happening was essentially that it was the idea that there are some people saying at that point, well, there's no point in even doing any more than this. We have the evidence that exists. It's in the journals. Let's stop doing all these stupid, touchy-feely, assertion-based treatments, and let's do operant treatments because those are the ones that... And that's where I said this is politics masquerading as science. So right. That.
I try to explain this stuff to my wife. Her eyes glaze over. But I found a way to explain it to her. Did you ever play that game at the beach called Whack-A-Mole?
Yeah.
Where the head, where you have
right,
a big
yes,
mallet
right.
and the
yeah.
head pops up and
right,
you knock
yes.
the head down, but then
right.
another head pops up. I think what's so frustrating about these very fluency behavioral based researchers and therapists is that they don't understand that stuttering is whack-a-mole.
Right.
So if you reduce the stuttering, it's, in my experience, we should be very careful to call that a victory because, you know, what else is going on? And, you know, my experience has been, well, is the person saying what they want to say? I mean, it seems obvious
yeah.
to us, but there seems to be a big, deep, dark divide in our field. And I'm getting the feeling that, like, clearly on Stutter Talk, we get it and you get it, but I think a lot of people just don't get it.
Right, right. And I think that's the biggest thing, I think, is that, you know, and because I think stuttering is not necessarily a difficult disorder to get, but it does take a little bit of work, as you say. You know, you have to really take some time to understand stuttering and the person who stutters or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think that people just don't necessarily want to take all that time. You know, it's just like, yeah, this is just too much, and I just, therefore, I don't really want to put in the effort. And I'd rather sort of shortcut things, say, well, people who stutter, they're just nervous, or they just, you know, they just aren't trying hard enough or whatever it might be, and look for these simple answers. And I think that stuttering makes sense, but it makes sense in the context, as you say, of a disorder that varies, you know, and a disorder that people who stutter are trying to avoid to different degrees. And all the reactivity we see in stuttering comes out of that as well. and that actually will tie into the forward moving speech stuff that we'll be talking about as well.
Well, so. That is, I think this is a great place to take a break. We're listening to Stutter Talk with Dr. Bob Quisel. And when we come back, let's talk about forward moving speech.
Okay, great.
Friends, we'll be having our 13th annual convention this July 22nd to 24th in Chicago. We encourage you all to come. Alan Rabinowitz will be our keynote speaker. There will be panels of kids who stutter, teens who stutter, parents, workshops, sibling workshops. Stutter Talk will be there joining us this year. For more information, you can check our website at www.friendswhostutter.org, and the workshops and schedules will be online.
Welcome back to Stutter Talk. We are here with very special return guest, Dr. Robert Quisel. Eric Jackson is in the production booth today. Stutter Talk can be reached at 206-888-4619, stuttertalk@stuttertalk.com. Dr. Quisel is going to be presenting in February and March. In February, Dr. Quisel is going to be presenting at the Illinois State Convention, and in March at the College of St. Rose, he's going to be a keynote speaker and running some other workshops there. We're going to get the exact dates up on Stutter Talk and try to link to the websites. Dr. Quisel, you got the energy to talk about some forward-moving speech?
Sure, you bet.
You and Dean Williams and others are really in influencing me a lot in how I think about stuttering and therapy. And I read you guys a few years ago. I read your articles and Dean Williams, and it took a few years for it to really click for me, and it is starting to click. And I want to read to you a quote. You said that Dean Williams helped me to be a better thinker. How did he help you think about stuttering?
Well, I think that, thinking about stuttering is thinking about a number of things, but I think that just the whole notion of not necessarily taking things at face value and, you know, thinking deeply. In fact, when I did my, doctoral defense, I had a legal pad with me, and I wrote up in the corner of the legal pad, "Think deeply," and because that's what he used to always say to me. I think I had this penchant. I probably still do for sort of blurting things out. You know, I'd sort of say the first thing that came to mind or whatever. And he sort of taught me that it's probably better to sort of think and ponder things a bit, and not necessarily say the first thing that comes to mind, but maybe, you know, think about things a little more, or maybe try to flesh out your response a little bit more. Because again, you know, you sound, in fact, perhaps on this podcast, people will realize what it's like when you blurt the first thing that comes to mind. But the whole notion of just, you know, trying to look at things more in more detail, think about things from a number of different views, gather evidence, those sorts of things that help you to come to better conclusions, better decisions, those sorts of things.
Yeah, and when you say gather evidence, I'm pretty sure you mean of the individual stutterer, of the person.
Right,
that
right.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah,
right.
And that's very powerful. And you and Dr. Williams both talk about this idea of stuttering becoming an it. And I think Dean Williams even suggested becoming an it or a magical an entity. What did you guys, or what do you mean by that?
Well, again, you know, I think that one of the best articles for anybody to read, I think, if, you know, I still have my students read Williams' 1957 point of view about stuttering. I think it's a really classic article, even though it's, what now, you know, 50-some years old.
It's a great
But again,
article,
it really it really is. I think it's probably one of the best articles about stuttering that's ever been written. If you really, again, want to understand stuttering, you want to understand what the disorder is really all about, and the notion that, and I think it's important to view that article, because I know that when you guys were talking about it, you and Joe and Eric were talking about it in a podcast a couple weeks ago or thereabouts, you were, I think Eric and Joe were having a little bit of trouble understanding some of the things that William Williams was talking about, and I think it's important to view that article in the context of somebody who doesn't know much about stuttering. In other words, the person who stutters as a, what I used to refer to as a virgin stutterer, hasn't been tainted by speech therapy. You know, in other words, you come into this, and what is stuttering like to the person who stutters who has not been told about stuttering? In other words, what's the experience of stuttering like when you haven't had people telling you, or you haven't read stuff about stuttering, and you haven't been told about things that stuttering is supposed to be or whatever? And you think about the experience of stuttering, and again, it's loss of control. You know, the idea that you're talking along and for whatever reason you get stuck. You know, your speech just stops working. Your mechanism doesn't move ahead. You're unable to continue to say what you want to say.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of it, this thing inside of me that makes me unable to say what I want to say. And I really believe that if you talk to people who stutter, and again, have them go back, you know, it's not like, well, you know, talk to me now that you've, you know, thought about stuttering for, you know, for 6 months or 2 years or 20 years or whatever it might be. But think back to when you were a kid, for example, and you first were experiencing stuttering, and what was it like for you? And it feels like something is taking control of your speech mechanism. And it grabs you and it shakes you, and then when it's ready, it lets you go. And that's what the experience of stuttering is like. And that's why people come to believe that stuttering is a part of them. It's something inside of me. And so it's not an irrational or illogical way of thinking about stuttering, but it's what people who stutter come to think about the disorder based upon the experiences that they have.
So this, is this it sort of? This idea that stuttering, not only is it a loss of control, but that loss of control and maybe the fear and the shame make it hard to look at and hard to look at objectively. Is that part of it?
I think that's probably a little bit farther down the road. In other words, if you just think about the idea of stuttering as being a part of me, something inside of me, okay?
Okay.
That's sort of that core breakdown, that core loss of control. And then if you read Williams further, okay, this idea of the notion of thinking you're not able to talk in any other way, or thinking about speech as being this dichotomy of either being stuttered speech or fluent speech and those sorts of things, that is what evolves from that initial experience of loss of control that a person first experiences when they stutter. Okay, and I often talk about this in my classes. I think a good way to think about it would be: imagine if when you were learning to drive, if the car that you learned to drive in for whatever reason, okay, would intermittently just veer to the right. Yeah. In other words, for no reason, okay, you're driving down the road and all of a sudden this car just veers to the right, okay? Now, what would that do to you as a driver? In other words, how would you differ in the way you would learn to drive if you had this vehicle that would periodically veer to the right? And you probably would, for example, hold the steering wheel a little bit tighter than other people would. You probably would tend to favor the left a little bit because you would think that, well, I don't know when this car is going to veer to the right, but it's probably going to veer to the right at some point, so I better be hanging on and being sure that I'm kind of, you know, holding the wheel a little bit more to the left just in case this car is going to veer to the right. And so after a period of time, you know, you would not drive the way that other people drove. You know, you would have this kind of funky way of driving that would come about because of your early experiences of driving in this car that did something different, you know, at unexpected times. So we think about the person who stutters, okay, their early experiences with speaking involve these unexpected, intermittent, unpredictable breakdowns in speech fluency that then lead to compensating behaviors that become part of the problem, but they weren't there at first.
Right. So what did Dean Williams suggest? I mean, how would you describe his approach?
The idea is that we're really dealing with stuttering at two levels, if you will. There's the core loss of control, okay? That's always going to be there. In other words, stuttering involves loss of control, okay? And so this notion that, you know, there's a good chance that you are going to at some point have that loss of control. But then built on that, or sort of added onto that, are the coping mechanisms, what I refer to as the reactivity that occurs because you're trying to keep yourself from stuttering. You don't want that to happen. In other words, nobody likes to stutter, okay? I've never met a stutterer who said to me, you know, I find stuttering to be a really enjoyable experience.
Right.
This is really cool stuff. This is really great. You know, I live to stutter. That's not what people say. They say, I don't like stuttering. It's uncomfortable. It's embarrassing. It's, you know, whatever terms people use. Stuttering is not a pleasant experience. And so therefore people who stutter try to do things to prevent that from happening. And the other thing that Williams talked about, and I think it makes sense, he talks about feelings, you know, the notion of how the feelings often dictate behavior as well. And you think about how that evolves as well. When the person who stutters first has the experience of stuttering, okay, you know, again, you will stutter, and maybe at first nothing happens, you know, you stutter, so you're talking along and you struggle, and you get the word out, and everything is cool. But then maybe the kid gets a little bit older, and so he's in a speaking situation, and he has some trouble. And maybe there's somebody there. And so somebody says to him in either a good-natured or in a mean-spirited way, you know, what's the matter? Can't you talk? Or, you know, one of the classic ones, you know, somebody says to you, what's your name? And you have a block on your name. And somebody says, what's the matter? Don't you know your own name?
Right.
You know, yeah. And so then what happens is there's social penalty associated with having a fluency breakdown. So therefore what happens is that fluency breakdown becomes associated with this uncomfortable emotional feeling. You know, I don't like when I stutter. It makes me feel emotionally uncomfortable. But then what tends to happen is that the person may be in a situation where maybe they feel a little bit anxious for some other reason. Let's say, for example, that the kid is going to school the first day or something like that. Or he's in a situation, some other situation. Well, he then has that feeling, you know, that feeling of sort of being nervous or anxious or whatever. And he goes, you know, I had this feeling before when I stuttered. And this feeling must be telling me that I'm going to stutter. So I better do something to make sure that I don't stutter. And so what happens is that the feeling that previously followed stuttering, I stuttered, I was embarrassed, I stuttered, I suffered a social penalty, you know, whatever it might be, now precedes the stuttering, or precedes this idea that I'm going to stutter because I have this feeling of stuttering, that old stutter feeling is here.
So the thoughts you have about past experiences and the way you prepare for that stuttering event become part of the stuttering,
right? Yeah. Now that wasn't there at first. That's not that core stuttering that gets added on. So the person then begins to do things like, well, I better be careful. I better look for words that might give me trouble. I better look for cues that are going to suggest to me that stuttering is going to happen. I better start. So the person's now, again, this is the person is driving the car that veers to the right. Their whole way of approaching talking is nothing like what a normally fluent person's speech is like. Your life is spent trying to not stutter versus talking fluently. And, you know, Williams just talked about, and I think Van Riper talked about this as well. You know, if you put a board on the floor, you know, put a 2x12 plank on the floor, and say to somebody, walk across the board. They'll just do it. They walk across the board. That's pretty easy. Now we raise it 20 feet in the air and now say, walk across the board. Well, the task is no longer walk across the board. It's not falling off the board, not falling and breaking your neck. Well, walking and not falling are two different things. Okay,
that's a great point. So,
talking and not stuttering are two different things.
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I was going to try to beat you to that, but that's terrible. I should give you the moment.
That's fine.
I'm going to let you. Could you say that one more time?
Yeah, just like talking and not stuttering are two different things.
Right.
Trying to not stutter is not the same as talking fluently.
Yeah.
So the whole idea of forward moving speech is let's get the person thinking more about what do you do when you talk fluently, as opposed to what do you have to do to not stutter.
Okay, I am with you completely. Here's where I'm struggling a little bit. This is where I think Dean Williams and you start to talk about the normal speech process and capturing those non-stuttered, quote, normal moments of talking. Can you explain that a little bit about what that is and how you do it?
Well, again, the thing you have to understand, I think, is that people who stutter don't really talk in a normal way. That's what I was saying, was that, you know, it's not normal speech, so I don't want to call it normal fluent okay. because it's not. But the person who stutters is fluent more than they're not fluent,
okay.
I think is an important thing to keep in mind. The person who stutters tends, again, keep in mind, this is the person who's not had a lot of therapy, who doesn't know a lot about stuttering still, okay? Think about this as part of the therapy process. We're trying to help our clients understand what they are going through as a person who stutters. So this person now is thinking, you know, I've got this thing about me, you know, I can't talk in any other way. This is something about me or whatever, okay? So we start to explain to the person, you know, talking is one of the most complex things that we do. You know, I talk in my speech science class, you know, I always say to my students, you know, the question is not why do people have disorders, communication disorders. The question is why do so few people have communication disorders given the complexity of talking, what we have to do to be able to put a message together.
I've heard you say that. It's a great point. It's like, why don't more people stutter?
Right, exactly. Talking is hard to do. It's a hard thing. So we want to impress upon our clients, you know, that when you're talking, you know, it's not just words falling out of your mouth. It's a matter of you've got to coordinate all these different systems, and you've got to understand, you know, this is what talking involves. Okay, you know, you breathe, that's the energy source, you make sound at your larynx, you know, you have to turn the voicing off and on for voice and voiceless sounds, you know, you can change, you know, your loudness, your pitch, you know, you add this little lilt to your voice, things like that. Then you shape the sound with your speech structures, you know, and this sound, this thing comes out that we call speech, and that's how we talk to people. And so you teach the person about the whole idea of talking, what talking involves. You don't want them to focus on stuttering. You want them to focus on talking. You know, you're a person who speaks. You know, you're not a person who stutters. You're a person who speaks. And that speech contains disruptions, things that interfere with the forward flow of speech. Okay. And we want to deal with those things. But first we want to find out what goes on when people talk. What goes on when you talk? How do you talk? You know, are you aware of things like, you know, how much effort are you using? How much, you know, how much air are you using? You know, how are you using your voice? Those sorts of things. And so when you sort of build in that understanding of talking, the person appreciates, yeah, it's not just that I stutter, the words get stuck, but this is the sort of process that I have to go through in order to speak. And I'm doing things, you know, I'm moving my speech system, if you will. And the other thing that's very interesting about stuttering, of course, and you probably had this experience as well, you know, if somebody sort of jumps in, you know, if you're on a block or whatever, somebody either says something or maybe provides a tactile cue to touch you on the arm or something like that, you'll often sort of come out of that block, you know. In other words, the stuttering block is not necessarily a totally involuntary thing, in the sense that we often add excess effort to the block in our attempts to struggle through that block. Okay?
Oh, yeah.
And I think the last time I was on, I think we talked about Phil Schneider's example of the person who can't swim when they fall in the water, you know, and they thrash around. Whereas if they would simply let themselves relax, they would float, you know, and they end up drowning because they don't understand that if you simply kind of let the system take care of itself and relax, you can float versus trying to not drown. You end up drowning, you know, same idea of like walking across the board or whatever. But anyway, the notion is letting the person's stutters understand that a lot of what you're doing to really try to push through that block are things that you're doing. In other words, the core loss of control is not voluntary, but your attempts to push through the block are voluntary. You can control the amount of effort you're putting into your attempts to make that stutter stop or work through that stutter or whatever you want to call it. So making the person more aware of what they're doing as a speaker, what structures are involved. And then the notion becomes, okay, when you are blocking, what do you do when you block? Are you having blocks at the level of the larynx, you know, or you have a lot of this kind of stuff, or are you having, you know, blocks, more in terms of like moving the articulatory structures, you know, you're having blocks, you know, bilabials or alveolars or whatever. And the notion is that when the person's able to sort of identify where their blocks are, then okay, what can we do to make that less effortful? So maybe you're getting into more fluency shaping kind of stuff then. So maybe it's more easy onset kind of stuff. You're in the block and you ease through it, which then becomes sort of like a Van Riper pullout kind of a thing.
This is such a rich. I love this stuff. Can I just throw out a few things real?
Sure. Yeah. Go ahead.
So what you're saying is that we're identifying what's interfering with the forward flow of speech.
Right.
And I'm working now with several clients who, when I ask them why are they stuttering, so we'll do this thing whether they're children or adults. When they get stuck, we'll stop. Or not when they get stuck. When they stutter, we'll stop, and I'll say, "What did you do?"
Uh-huh.
And it's so interesting that a lot of the time they'll say, "Oh, I always get stuck there." That's what always happens. So before we even get to where is the airflow, where's the tongue, where are the lips, where are you tense, where's the mind? You know, what are you thinking about? And I took that from what you and Dean Williams have written too, where it's not only motoric things that interfere with speech, it's our feelings and our thoughts about this disorder.
But again, you know, the idea is if you start to think differently about your speech, you know, in other words, I can do something. I'm not totally helpless in the face of this block. I can struggle differently. I can struggle with less effort. I can work through the block differently. I can make the block less severe, whatever it might be. Okay. Because a lot of the severity of stuttering, again, comes from the reactivity. It's not that the core stuttering itself. It's the reactivity. It's the struggle. It's the fighting. I've got to get through this block, and I don't want to be here. I want to be somewhere else. And so, therefore, I'm going to either try to push through it as hard as I can, or I'm going to back up. You know, I come to a word that's a difficult word, and I come to a difficult word, and I don't actually try to attack the word. I simply try to wait till I feel I'm ready to say it. So the person backs up, and you have these phrase repetitions or word repetitions where they're not really attacking that word or that sound, but they're simply backing up from it. And so, you know, we often see these kinds of blocks in our clients. You know, I'm trying to think of a good example, a recent example, and of course, when I'm trying to think of one, I can't do it. But, you know, people will often, like, we're thinking that they're blocked on an S, for example. So like a word like stutter, let's say, they'll do like st, and they're not blocking and stuttering. They can't get voicing going for the and stutter. So if they could go stutter and ease into the stutter, then they'd be okay, but they're doing and they can't get voicing going.
Yeah.
And so if they understand that, you know, the reason you're having trouble is not that you're going stuff, you're just not allowing yourself to move ahead and get your vocal folds relaxed to go move into stutter.
Yeah.
And so if this person understands the nature of their speech mechanism and how things work, then they can start to problem solve and say, oh, well, maybe I can try to do that differently and I don't have to back up, or I can attack that word differently.
Yeah, I love doing this, not doing this therapy. I love this idea of talking with clients about what's interfering with speech, because I'm seeing light bulb moments with my clients.
Exactly.
Yeah. I'll share a couple with you because I want to share, Bob.
That's great.
one is, and I'm going to make this sentence up, but I recently had a client who was stuttering on, let's say, I just bought a new cell phone. And they realized that they were stuttering on the word cell phone.
Uh-huh.
But they actually were heard to stutter on words before it, on bought and new.
Uh-huh.
And that was like a light bulb moment. Like, wait a second. They're doing things that sound like stuttering or are stuttering to prevent us another stutter from occurring.
Right.
And then, of course, the challenge is, well, what can we do differently so that we don't do those things? So that when we come up to that feared sound, we do something else that's different. I'm starting to use I don't want to get into politics, but I'm starting to think of this as like a preemptive strike. You know, like if we feel that something coming on, well, what can we do preemptively to change, to do something different? I want to throw out a few wrenches for you, things that well, I mean, I'm sure you've seen this in therapy.
Yeah.
What about the client, and it's usually a child, but it can be an adult too, who comes to you and you're doing this type of stuff, this what's interfering with speech, and the client doesn't want to look at their stuttering in an objective way. They don't want to talk about it. They don't want to put it in their mouth and do it again. They don't want to tell you how they stuttered. And then it's sort of a roadblock where they're coming every week and, you know, it could be they're coming because mom's taking them, or it could be they're coming because they want to make changes, but they don't want to jump in the pool yet. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think one of the important things that I try to emphasize in all my writings about Williams therapy is that it's not for everybody. In other words, you have to have a client who does want to think about their speech and problem solve and try things. Because a lot of it is just kind of playing around with speech as well. Mm-hmm. Try this, do things differently or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I think that whenever a client is not responding to the therapy, you need to try something different, you know, and so you need to change things in some way, and it may be a matter of doing more, let's say, drill work. In other words, you have a client, and maybe you've identified things that you think are things that they're doing that maybe are less than effective, and you can maybe just do some drill things or whatever. I don't like doing that, but if the client doesn't really want to play an active role in therapy in terms of thinking about their speech and being willing to modify and those sort of things, then you say, well, okay, let's do some other things. Or what I often like to do with any client is say, well, you know, what do you want to get out of therapy? What's not working? What about therapy could be done better, done differently, or whatever? Mm-hmm. And again, you often have clients who just are like, well, no, this is all fine. This is all great. You know, we come here for, you know, every week for therapy, and we sit here and you try to get me to do things and I don't do them, and then the session ends and I go home, you know? And so, but you have to find something that works for that client. And so, if the problem solving, the more active approach doesn't work, you've got to get them into something that's more passive, where they do things that are more like, well, here's some drill work. And it certainly doesn't get as much bang for the buck. But clients may not be ready for this kind of therapy, because they really need to be vested in wanting to learn about their speech, wanting to change what they're doing, wanting to really try to explore the nature of their stuttering and the nature of their speech. And if they don't want to do that, this therapy is not going to work.
This is probably the same exact issue, but then there's also the client who comes to you, and we try to look at what's interfering with forward-moving speech, and the client says, well, I'm just going to fail because I always fail.
Right.
Yeah, I'm sure you've – so, I mean, would you say that's the same thing where, well, then this isn't going to work for that person?
Well, I think the thing is you want to – my mantra has always been success breeds success. I think that going back to when I was a client in therapy, and this is like, you know, as I was saying to my students when I used to ride my dinosaur to classes when I was a college student, but anyway, you know, when I would have one of those aha moments in therapy where I would do something or learn something and it was like, whoa, you know, then suddenly it's like I can do this. And I think that it's important to even if the client comes in and says this is not going to work because I've previously failed in therapy, You want to approach it with, well, this is different. We're going to do some different things in here, and I want you to understand that, you know, you always ought to preface things. I think it's important to say therapy is not the real world. That things will happen in therapy that may not work outside of therapy, and that's okay. And you want to prime them for that whole notion of therapy as a controlled environment. We do things in therapy that we may not do outside. we may do stupid things in therapy that are sort of not necessarily embarrassing, that may be too strong of a word, but we'll do silly things in therapy. We'll kind of play around with speech, and we'll do different things in therapy, and mm-hmm. and we're not going to expect you to go out and necessarily do the same things that you're doing in here. But, you know, let's be willing to try different stuff when we're in here in this therapy setting. And let's just see. You know, we're not going to make any sort of predictions about what's going to happen. But let's just try stuff. And I think if you make therapy enjoyable, I was going to say fun. I don't know if fun is the right word. But if you make it sort of an enjoyable, interesting, challenging sort of an environment for the client, and you let them explore, a lot of what I like about Williams therapy is that it's not scripted. You have to be flexible. And so you go into therapy and you say, let's try this, but you don't know where the client is necessarily going to take you in therapy, because you don't know how the client's going to respond to the things that you're going to try. So you've got to be willing to sort of follow the client's lead.
Yeah.
And again, if the client starts to have some success, if he or she experience things that they haven't experienced before, if they are able to, you know, work through a block that they haven't been able to work through before, they're able to do something they haven't done before. You know, my experience at college, where I'd go outside with my student clinicians, and we would, you know, go to stores and stuff, and I'd go to a clerk and I'd say, can I, you know, whatever, and I'd say things that I'd never thought I could say before, because I'd been pretty covert as well. And therefore, it's like, holy mackerel, if I say the words I want to say, I can actually say them, you know, if I, you know, and so, you know, if the client has those moments of like, this works, this is making a difference, then I think that'll help them to be motivated. So I don't know if the client comes in and says, this is not going to work, and I'm convinced it's not going to work, and they try to sort of undermine therapy, that's a problem.
Yeah.
But if they come in and they're willing to work, I think that you can usually get some success, and that builds success.
Bob, I am thinking we need to take an unprecedented second break. Would you be willing to come back for one
sure.
last third of Stutter
you
Talk? Okay.
You betcha.
Hey, everybody. This is Joe Klein from the College of St. Rose, and I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about thinking about contributing to the great work that Eric and Peter do at StutterTalk.com. And in fact, if you go to www.StutterTalk.com, there is a button that you just have to hit that will allow you to donate to the great work that Peter and Eric do. I think all of us know how many hours they put in each week to do this. And then on top of that, the expenses of going to conferences, interviewing people. I think what Stutter Talk does is so special. And I know that for me personally, I've been thinking for a long time about contributing, and I'm definitely going to do that this week, and I hope that all of you do too.
Hey, it's Greg, and you're listening to Stutter Talk.
Hey, it's Steve, and you're listening to Stutter Talk.
Hey, 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 it's Josh, and you're listening to Stutter Talk.
Hey, it's Tommy, and you're listening to Stutter Talk.
Well, welcome back to Stutter Talk after an unprecedented second break. Peter Reitz is here with Dr. Robert Quiesel from the Communication Sciences and Disorders Program at Western Illinois University. Thanks for staying on, Bob.
You bet.
We got an email from Ari from Israel. He was a little confused about the difference between forward-moving speech and stuttering modification. therapy. Can you take a moment and talk about how they're similar and different?
Well, I think basically that full blown speech would fall under the heading of a stuttering modification approach to therapy. So, the notion of fluency shaping, which is focused on fluent speech, and stuttering modification, which focuses on making the stuttering less severe, modifying the nature of the stuttering block to make it less effortful or whatever. And I think that full blown speech probably incorporate some fluency shaping concepts, I would say as well, in the sense that the idea that when you sort of identify what works for you to help you to speak in a more effective way, that's the term that Williams used that I like. It's not normal fluency, but it's the more effective speech for you. You want to try to maximize that. Try to talk that way as much as possible. So when you sort of identified the proper amount of muscular effort that you use, for example, your breathing pattern, your speaking rate, whatever, that's the sort of zone you want to be in as much as possible. And to some extent, that almost becomes like a fluency shaping sort of a way of looking at things. But the notion with the four movie speech approach, I think, is that the client, by learning about speech and learning about stuttering and learning about his stuttering or her stuttering, then can I identify the things that he or she does to interfere with speech, and then can find ways to change those behaviors to make them less effortful, to make them less interfering, if you will. And so, again, the person who, has a certain way of doing things, again, like we were talking about, if, for example, the person has trouble getting voicing going. So you have a lot of things in your speech where there are these effortful things, or, like we talked about with your stuttering, not because you're repeating the ST blend, because you're not getting the voicing going for the voiced vowel that follows. You can begin to learn ways to produce words in a less effortful way, and that again becomes more like a Van Riper sort of a pullout kind of a thing. And there are many parallels between the things that Van Riper talked about and the things that Williams talked about, because they basically were contemporaries in terms of, they did practice at the same time. They did a lot of things together. They were on a lot of the SFA panels. When they used to have those meetings where all the experts would get together and they would put together a book or whatever. Many of the chapters in those books were authored by Williams and Van Riper, not as co-authors, but really one chapter by Williams and one by Van Riper. So I don't think that there's a lot of difference between a stuttering modification approach and a full-blown speech approach, other than the fact that they might approach things a little differently, but the end result is still the same, making stuttering less effortful and trying to make the final product, if you will, the final speech, less disruptive, easier fluency, easier stuttering. That's more satisfying to both the speaker and the listener.
Well, what I like about the forward-moving speech approach is that it doesn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Like, I think fluency shaping basically throws the baby out with the bathwater. So, and what I like about the forward-moving speech, or at least my understanding of it, is you're really focusing on what is interfering with speech. And if you're at a moment where nothing is, then nothing is. But and so I do like that as aspect of it. And it's really making me think about the therapy that I do and the terminology I use, because I'm starting to think that a lot of the solid speech ideas might get lost in the terminology. So, I mean, I think a pullout or a cancellation, I think like a pullout. So when you're stuttering and you stay with the stutter and you work through it, it's a solid idea. But then when I find myself using the term pull out with a client, I feel like it's could be moving into the area of suggestion, whereas when working with somebody and you say, okay, pull out of it, and they do it. I'm wondering if that's kind of like what you were saying, where if you tap somebody on the arm, it's the same thing. And what I like about Dean Williams' approach and your approach is it really seems like the thinking person's approach. So instead of saying pull out of it, it's a longer sentence. Well, what are you doing and what can you do differently? You know, and that was a big thought.
What can you change there? You know, what, and I think that's important. And that's another thing. I remember you and Eric and Joe were talking about the idea of. Yeah, rather than using the term "what's happening," you say "what are you doing?" And again, it may be more of a semantic difference, but the idea of making the client realize that, you know, you can do something. You know, you're not helpless in the face of your stuttering. You can do something, even if it's to make the stutter different. You know, make it weird in a different way or whatever it might be. You know, you can do. You don't have to be helpless in the face of stuttering. You can do something. Even if it's just stopping, you know, I mean, if really, when you think about it, you know, when we're in a block, we could theoretically just stop and just make it, you know, just not do anything. And so all those struggles, all the fighting that we do, all the effort that we put into trying to make our stutter, you know, change in some way, you know, the idea is let's think of more productive things we can do in a positive way. Because, you know, the stutter's not happening to us. We're doing something that is making the stutter, you know, worse or harder, whatever it might be. And let's try to do things that make the stutter less severe. Let's try to work through it in a more productive sort of a way. And I think that's the notion of talking about what you're doing versus what's happening. It makes the person less of a passive participant in the process and more of an active participant.
Yeah, those are great points. And Joe Klein had a great point about this too, where the dean, as I think I remember this right, he said the Dean Williams approach and your approach can be a little scary because it's really putting the emphasis on what can the person who stutters do. It's basically saying this is your issue to deal with.
Well, and again, I think there's also a difference between saying that you're capable of being totally fluent versus You can make your stuttering different. You know, you can be stuttering less effortful, less severe, whatever it might be. Yeah. And I think that's the issue also, is that the idea is not, the message is not, you know, well, you do this and you're going to be fluent all the time.
Yeah.
It's, you know, you do these things and you will be able to maximize the efficiency of your speech, you know, and you'll be able to make your speech less effortful. And I think that's the ultimate goal. We're not talking about totally fluent speech.
Yeah, I totally agree. I'd like to share one more therapy success, if you don't mind. And
sure.
I'm careful about it because it's funny. I have a couple of clients who listen to the show. So I know that one of the clients is going to say, oh, that was me. But we were doing some of this forward-moving speech stuff, and when we were talking about what was interfering with speech, one of my clients realized when he was stuttering, he was sort of doing a double stutter. So he would prolong the sound and then repeat the syllable as well. So, you know, it didn't even occur to us to say, well, try not to stutter on it. What we talked about was, well, let's stutter on it differently. Can you choose one of those patterns? Can you stick with just the repetition or just the prolongation? And it just felt like such a healthy way to approach this disorder. I mean, it's wonderful stuff. Bob, we got an email, an anonymous email from a listener, and this is what the person wrote. When I am in a really hard silent block, I feel that the block is controlling me, and no matter what I try to do, I can't seem to break the hold it has on me. Any suggestions of how to get out of these blocks?
The thing is that, silent blocks are tough. I mean, again, they're tough because when you're in a silent block, the system is pretty much shut down, so you're pretty much stuck. And it's a matter of getting things going again. That's often harder than sort of like, you know, changing while you're moving along. But I think what a silent block does for you is it allows you time to do that sort of inventory of where am I blocking, how am I blocking, what exactly am I doing that's causing this problem. What often happens during a silent block, again, is, you know, you've got to do something to get the system moving, and that may often involve something like a gradual startup. So in other words, something like sort of a stretch, let's say, something like that. And so again, I can't think of necessarily a real good example, but you know, if you're trying to say, you know, I or something like that, you know, so you're stuck and you're trying to say, let's say my name is, okay, something like that. So you meet somebody at a party or whatever and they say, you know, well, hi, you know, I'm Peter Reitzes, who are you? And you want to say, I'm Bob Quisel or whatever, and you have one of those blocks, and you're like, and so it may be a matter of like, I'm Bob Quisel, something like that. What often happens in a silent block is that you think, well, no matter what I do to get started, it's going to sound stupid, it's going to sound weird, whatever it might be, because that silent block sort of lead to this kind of an expectation on the part of the listener. You know, it's any sort of a pause, you know, that sort of pregnant pause, whatever's coming next is going to be really good or whatever. So you have to kind of get over that notion of that I have to be really fluent after I get out of this block, because if I don't, it's not going to sound right or something like that. So learning stretches, learning easy onset kind of things or whatever to get you out of the block. And again, using the block for an inventory, maybe whatever the nature of the block is, that a stretch or an easy onset is not going to really work. But typically something like that will help to get you out of the block. But you've got to practice that. And I think that's the biggest challenge, is that you can sit in therapy for hours on end going, you know, I'm Bob Quisel, my name is Bob Quisel, and you can do it well, but then when you actually are at that party on New Year's Eve or whatever, and somebody says, hi, you know, I'm Peter Reitzes, what's your name? And you go, and in the back of your mind, there's that time in your life where somebody said to you, what's the matter? Don't you know your own name or whatever?
Yeah.
And so there's all those things that kind of get involved as well. But I think you've got that block for the inventory. Where am I blocking? How am I blocking? Can I do something to lessen the effort and get the system moving again? I think that's the best thing you can do during those silent blocks.
Did you have time for a couple more, Bob?
Yeah, you bet. You bet.
Another challenge, there's lots of good challenges that come up in the therapy, is that when we're doing this what interferes with normal speech thing, which is just really dominating the therapy I'm doing right now, I'm finding that with some people who stutter, what's interfering with forward-moving speech are residual speech therapy techniques that they're using. Or maybe they're not so residual. But I'll find that sometimes a client, and I've had several clients recently do this, where they realize that they're probably using some form of fluency shaping or easy vocal onset, and it's interfering. Do you have some thoughts on that?
Well, that's what I refer to as artifacts of previous therapy, and we often have those, again, because when you get a client who has had therapy before, you have a combination of, you know, things that they've been taught that they maybe have misunderstood or they've misapplied, you know, or things that have stopped working, you know. So again, you get the person who at one time was learning easy onsets, you know, and now you hear that kind of a behavior or whatever. And so I think that, again, the thing you have to do is, you know, part of it is maybe unlearning those behaviors that are interfering, that have become interfering behaviors, you know, even though maybe at one time they were meant to serve some sort of a therapeutic purpose. But the other thing is, again, you have to sort of, you know, fight your battle as well. And the question then becomes, you know, if they truly do interfere with speech, then you have to sort of do something to shape them, change them, modify them, whatever it might be. But if they don't really interfere, in other words, if they're sort of there, but they're just sort of like annoying, a good word, maybe at that point in time, you know, if person, for example, the person, you know, they're talking in a way that, you know, it suggests that, you know, I used to have fluency shaping at one time and this is how I talk now. Well, if their speech has that quality, so I would say if we can do things to establish the fluency, we can probably build in that more natural prosody later. So I guess, again, like a lot of other things, you have to kind of weigh it and say, to what extent is it really a problem? Is it really interfering? Does it need to be changed right now versus can we sort of put it in the back burner and then deal with it later in therapy? And again, that's more of a case-by-case sort of a thing. But certainly, I've dealt with some clients, like I say, who at one point they'd learned easy onsets, and now they're just struggling to even get a word out that they're doing these like hard laryngeal blocks every time they're trying to say a word that starts with a vowel or something like that. So yeah. that needs to be addressed. But I think you just deal with that on a case-by-case basis.
So I don't know if you want to answer from an expert clinician's point of view or from an expert stuttering point of view, being, you know, a person who stutters, but whether, yeah. So as a therapist, I struggle with this idea. And as a person who had therapy for, I guess, 4 or 5 years, I struggle with this idea of wanting people to listen and of wanting instruction. And there are times where you go into therapy and you want somebody to tell you what to do. And there are times as a therapist where you want to say, where you want to be an instructor, where you want to not only give guidance, but say, let's do this today. However, I also know that a huge aspect of therapy is listening. So that's a big balancing act. How do you balance listening to someone's experience and to have them find their own way with wanting to be the instructor who gives advice?
Yeah, I think my sort of rule of thumb on that is I think that self-discovered knowledge tends to have a lot more power than when you're told something. Even you go back to, you know, when you were a kid, you know, and your parents told you something that was like, whatever, blah, 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 mom and dad, you know, whatever. And then when you actually were the person who, like, you know, set your hand on fire with a firecracker or whatever.
Right.
It just seems like that kind of stuff. You know, when you figure it out on your own, you think, this was my idea, it's a lot more powerful because I figured it out, you know. And I really prefer to try to guide my clients in certain directions. So, for example, you know, you have a client and you say to them, you know, they're doing something like my name is, and you say, well, where were you blocking there? And they're saying, I think it's up my larynx. And you want to go, no. You are voicing. You couldn't possibly have been blocking right. Your larynx. Come on. Yeah. But instead you want to go, well, let's think about that for a second. Let's do that again. Okay. You know, my name. Put your hand on your throat. You feel your larynx. And my name. Now, can you feel anything there? You know, and so you take that extra few seconds or whatever to kind of guide them, and then, oh, no, it could be in my larynx. It must be, oh, maybe my lips. And you go, yeah, good answer. And I think that's a lot more powerful than they're like, oh, I figured out what I was doing, you know, even though you know the answer.
Yeah, see, now that's
– To be able to hang back.
Yeah. No, well, it's so interesting of where you jumped in, because that's great stuff. But then there's even the idea of, well, what I want to do today as the therapist is help you identify what's interfering with your speech. However, even doing that is I'm still guiding the therapy. However, so many of the clients I work with will come in and we'll never get to that, I feel, unless I steer it in that direction. In fact, I have clients, children, teens, and adults who come in and literally they want to work, but they'll say, what do you think I should do? And that's a tough one too. I mean, how do you handle the, what do you think I should do?
What do you think I should do about my stuttering, or what should I do to talk differently, or what should I do to, you know, I mean, when they say what should I do, what level are they asking, what should I do?
Oh, good point. When somebody comes into therapy and you say to them, what would you like to work on today? What would you like to share with me today? And they say, well, I was hoping you'd tell me what to do today.
The thing I would say is, okay, tell me about something, you know, tell me something about your speech in the last, whatever, since the last session. Tell me about your speech that was, you know, either good or bad, you know, something that sticks in your mind about your speech or your stuttering, a situation, you know, something like that. And then you start to talk about, okay, here's a situation where something happened, you got stuck, you stuttered, you didn't try to approach a situation, whatever it might be, and then you use that as kind of the jumping off point. Well, okay, because that thing happened, therefore there's something about your speech then that's a problem that was interfering. And it could be, again, not necessarily at a behavioral level, maybe more at a cognitive level or an affective level. And again, one of the nice things about forward-moving speech is you can talk about the touchy-feely stuff in the context of asking questions as well. So, the notion there would be, well, let's use that experience then to sort of think about some things that we can do today in therapy that will address that experience you had within the last, week or so. And you can use that kind of as a jumping-off point.
Oh, I love that. So you're putting it back on them in a nice way of, well, still tell me what's important, what's happened recently.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. That's great.
And if they said something like, well, nothing happened with my speech, well, why not? Well, I haven't talked in the last week. Well, okay, why haven't you talked in the last week?
Mm.
So, you can and that's where you start going, what the hell are you doing? if you haven't talked, did you have a chance to talk to people and you chose not to talk? Or are you starting to become more covert? So there are a lot of ways you can get doors open and you can start. But I always say to my students, don't be lesson plan bound. In other words, if your client comes in and says, I had a horrible weekend because people were making fun of me, and you say, well, that's really interesting, but today's our day to work on easy onsets,
right.
That's not the way to do therapy, So I think that you can usually draw your client out and find something that they'd want to talk about or work on. But again, the whole disorder of stuttering, not just fluency, but they come in and say, well, what do you want to do today? And you say, well, or what should I do today? And you say, well, let's talk about what you've experienced with your stuttering, again, at multiple levels.
Mm-hmm.
Stuttering as a disorder is part of your life, and let's think what we need to talk about today. Stuttering is part of your life.
I see. I know. I think you just answered this, but I have one last question to throw at you. We get different types of emails at Stutter Talk. So one of the types we get is from Ari, who'll say, you've talked about these ideas, explain them more. And then we'll get a second type of email saying, I love your show, but you guys make it sound so easy. And for me, it's not easy. I'm in a really bad place. I can't get where you guys are. I can't do what you guys do. What do you say to the person who might hear us talk or Eric talk or Joe Klein talk? What do you say to that person who feels either intimidated by that or feels like I'm just not there? It's really bad for me right now.
Yeah, well, it is true that we're lucky in the sense that, I talk about stuttering, all the time. I think about it all the time. I read about it all the time. I've got a lot of friends who stutter, colleagues who are interested in stuttering. So I'm lucky in the sense that I spend a lot of time sort of immersed in the disorder. I have chances to practice my speech skills. I get to talk to you on the phone, for example, and I get to do both. I can stutter and I can work on my speech skills at the same time. But I think that you have to try to find somebody that you can talk with, work with. I think there's no substitute for good therapy. And again, the upper word there is good therapy. And the person is just stuck and can't find somebody, again, trying to connect via email, trying to find somebody who can do telehealth kind of therapy. It's easier now with webcam, things like that, to connect with people. You have to reach out and find somebody who can interact with you in a way that's going to be helpful and supportive. I don't believe you can do it by yourself. I really don't think you can. I think listening to these podcasts certainly helps. There's no question about it. But I think that to really learn the skills, practice the skills, master the skills, you have to have somebody who's going to be your coach, if you will. And that's really going to be a good SLP who knows about stuttering.
So
I would say if a person feels stuck, they need to find a way to find somebody that's going to be able to help them. That's probably maybe a difficult answer, but I think that's the most practical answer.
I think that is a great place to leave things. You've been listening to Stutter Talk, Peter Reitzes, with Dr. Robert Quiesel. We hope, Bob, that you come back and join us.
Oh, yeah, I'll be more than happy to chat with you guys. Thanks a lot.